Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Refs Roundup. It's great to be back in the studio to chat about the weekend's games and what's been happening in the world of refereeing. And a very lovely welcome today to my favourite NRL referee and favourite husband, Gavin Badger. Hello, Gav.
Hey, Case. How are you?
Going all right, thanks. So how was your weekend?
Our weekend was good. Spent it up in beautiful North Queensland. And the good thing about the weekend, you can see, you know, after the last few weeks they've had up there with all the floods and stuff, that there was some football and the town sort of getting back together, and it's, you know, there's a fair amount to do, but there's a fair amount that's been done up there. So, yeah, it was good to get up and see that and run around up in Townsville.
Did you get to see the base of the new stadium?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough that the hotel that I stayed in, I opened my blinds and the stadium was virtually there whacking me in the face. So it was really good. Actually, it brought a smile to my face to look at it and to see that it's taking shape now. So there's one end up and the two sides are starting to go up, and it's exciting times and really looking forward to seeing that stadium up and running.
Yeah, it'd be good for it to be in the centre of town there. We can pretty much walk there from that hotel as well.
Yeah, it's awesome.
What'd you like out of the weekend?
There's a couple of things. Good weekend of footy. We had a lot of tight, close games, you know, which culminated in three golden point games that all were decided by field goals. So you can't get much tighter than that. And there was a couple of other games that were really tight as well. Another game in Townsville at stages, it was 18-12. Mm. So potential that could have gone to golden point where the Cowboys were attacking the line late in the game. So, you know, tight scorelines. I also, it's a like and it's a dislike. The Corbin Sims playing with a broken arm for 25 minutes. I like it in the fact that, you know, it just shows the quality of Corbin Sims. He's a tough competitor. And, you know, not complaining, just finished the game, and then it was afterwards where he sort of started to talk about it. I don't like it because I don't like to see players get injured. And over the weekend we saw, you know, probably four or five high-profile, you know, top-end rugby league stars injured that are going to be out for quite a significant amount of time. Mm. So, you know, I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate seeing anyone get injured, let alone the stars of our game.
Yeah. It's definitely something you could never do.
What, get injured?
Play on with a broken arm.
I just won't break my arm. I've never had a broken bone in my body.
This is coming from the man who one day we were training in the off-season with Ashley Klein and Dave Munro. We were on a family holiday up the north coast, border of Queensland, and he was stretching down and all of a sudden started yelling and screaming that he would never walk again, and we found out he got bitten by an ant.
It was a big ant. It was a big ant. And can I tell you, it was painful. But I survived.
Thankfully, you're here to tell the story.
Bigger and better.
You'll have to write a book about it one day.
What did you take out of the weekend? What were your sort of takeouts?
Yeah, not one of the closer games of the weekend, but the dominant performance of the Roosters on Thursday night. Seeing any team sort of in full flight in attack is always, you know, as a rugby league fan, is great to see. But I'm calling it early in round four. We've seen the try of the year. Sure. That try at the dying stages of the game was just outstanding. And it showed I know we have the ability to have things checked at the NRL level, and when there are that many, knockbacks and drop balls and the kick and all that sort of stuff, we're always going to check it when we can, because we want to get it right. But the live calls of the referees throughout and the touch judges throughout that decision-making process of the however long that went for, you know, probably only went for 20 or 30 seconds, but watching it on TV, it felt like that play went for 5 minutes. It showed the quality of those officials to get it absolutely right at every stage of that play.
Yeah, and it'd be good too, and probably something we should do in the future is where we, you know, show some of that and put some of that audio up and let the people out there have a listen to what we do regularly in an NRL game and the amount of communication and the quality of the communication that we give.
Yeah, definitely. So that's definitely something that we'll look to do in the next few weeks, is to give you guys a bit of an insight into how it sounds on the field from a referee's perspective and how much communication there is between not only the four officials, but we have our match day coach at the ground as well. And you also hear at times from like the timekeeper as well, as we discussed last week with the scrum clocks and shot clocks.
Something else I just want to take out of that game on Thursday night is, I speak about earlier, getting bitten by an ant and that hurting. Imagine getting tackled by Victor Radley. Imagine that guy. He's tackle tech and I speak about probably one of the guys I think was the best at that was Nigel Plum
from
Canberra and the Roosters. I think his tackle tech and timing was outstanding, but this guy, if he hit me, I wouldn't be getting up. And we saw it over the weekend with a couple of games where there's some really great one-on-one strong defence. Martin Taupau's tackle on the goal line to save a try against South. I forget who had the ball. It might have been
Cameron Murray,
who is it? You know, like we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, he's on fire and a try-scoring machine. And Martin Taupau one-on-one just stopped him in his tracks and drove him backwards back on the other side of the goal line to save a try. And there was a few of those instances over the weekend where strong one-on-one defence. So good to see that in the game as well.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing I liked was the amount of one-on-one strips coming into the game. And we sort of discussed it as a refereeing group when the law changed in terms of what constituted a one-on-one strip versus a two-on-one strip. So in the past, there used to be the rule about if a player drops off the tackle, that it would still count as two in the tackle. So effectively, obviously, if there's one-on-one, you're always allowed to strip the ball. If two defenders came in, you're not allowed to strip it. If two defenders came in and one of those defenders fell off the tackle, then that other defender used to not be allowed to strip the ball.
Because is that 2 years now that rule's been enforced? Last season and this season?
Yeah. So, that wasn't allowed to happen. The ball carrier used to have to break the initial tackle. So if there were ever two people in the tackle, they'd have to both drop off and then one person go in to strip the ball. Now you can see two, three, four, however many defenders come into the tackle. As long as all bar one drop off, that one person is then allowed to strip the ball. And we sort of talked about it as a group, saying it would be interesting to see if any team sort of use that as a bit of a tactic in having some sort of call to drop off and then have someone strip the ball. And it's one of those things that's high risk if you get it wrong, but big reward if you get it right. And we saw some of them, as well as just your traditional one-on-one strips as well, which anytime there's that turnover of possession, it brings a bit of excitement to the game because it's going against the flow of the game.
Excitement, and there's not a lot of times in rugby league's very much defence orientated at the moment, so there's not a lot of times where you get to attack unstructured defence, and that's one. Because you've got players set up in positions because they think they're going to get the ball. All of a sudden, they're defending. So there's a scramble in defence. Yeah, I like it. I think it was Tyson Frisell's first touch of the ball. Mm. He strips the ball to score a try one-on-one. And as a rugby league fan and as a referee, we get the best of both worlds there because we're on the field and you actually hear players. Now, there are teams that have calls for it. So there'll be three defenders in and a player will say something. The other two will drop off so he can attempt to strip the ball. Mm. So, you know, they're working on it at training it creates a new phase of play for the game. So, yeah, it's good to see.
It's an example of where the two referee system works really well for us in that we have someone in front of the ball and behind the ball. So it doesn't matter which way the ball carrier turns, if they're getting turned in the tackle, we always have someone at every angle to see what's happening. So in one referee games, we used to see, and in lower grades in, you know, Queensland Cup and New South Wales Cup, sometimes we get decisions wrong on strips or, you know, lost balls because you just physically can't see how the ball came out because their back might have been turned to you or the ball was on the other side or whatever. But where we've got two referees, we can cover all those angles. And especially with the strip rule the way it is now, it makes it a heck of a lot easier for us. We've spoken in past weeks about things that are difficult for referees what are the harder decisions for us to make. But this is one that a rule change that has made things a lot easier.
Yeah, and also you speak about the two refs there. The benefit for that for us as well is if I'm behind the ruck in the assist role, I can see if a player's at the ball and trying to take it, which then gives me an opportunity to let the referee know not to call hell too early because we've still got competition for the ball. So we don't have those instances where player strips the ball after we've called hell and we have to blow a penalty. If we can see that he's in that action, we sort of hang off and delay our call. So that benefits everyone.
Yeah. We spoke about the obviously the quality of some of the games, but how close a lot of them were. And close games don't always lead to the most free-flowing football. Sometimes they do, but we saw I was on the Tigers and Penrith game on Friday night and being there at the, you know, obviously on the field and the crowds into it because the scoreline was tight the whole time, that made it, you know, exciting and you're sort of pumped up and, you know, it was awesome to be there. But towards in that second half especially, you know, there was a lot of forward passes, a lot of drop ball, a lot of stop-start sort of football. So it's not always free-flowing. But I just want to sort of talk about the pressure that those score lines place on referees. And, you know, you've been around forever and a day since 1908. So in your experiences, what are those pressures that I guess the referees and touch judges are placed under when our scoreline is so tight?
Yeah, you got a couple of factors in it because you got the situational stress of the game. So you got the scoreline, which you know that every decision you make is going to have an impact on the game, whether it be you call a knock-on that's wrong, whether you miss a strip, whatever. So you know that every decision is hot. And we know that in every game that we do anyway, but you have situational stress around scoreline. Mm-hmm. So what that does is it sort of raises the bar for you as an official. So you work, you know, it may sound like we should work harder all the time, but you just seem to work that bit harder and make sure you give yourself a little bit more room making decisions. So as an assist ref, we don't push in and try and get as much compliance around ruck because our big decisions at that stage of the game are decisions.
On board, what we call on board decisions.
We talk about, yeah, we've got to make on-ball decisions. So we give ourselves a little bit more depth, which gives us more time, which gives us more clarity, which opens up our view. So we have that factor. You also have the players are in that same situation as well. So we've also got to make sure that we don't lift in what we say and how we say it on the field because we want the players to start to do that as well because, you know, we want everything to be calm. The calmer everything is, the easier it is for our decision-making, whether that be our team as officials being calm or that being making sure we placating and putting out spot fires. We know players are starting to get angsty and heated in those moments where we do make big decisions, whether they be right or wrong. You know, players can get angsty and stuff. So if we go up with them, all of a sudden, you know, the last couple of minutes, which is frantic anyway, becomes almost like we're chasing our tail because we're getting frantic and we're letting the game get away from us. So we talk about that a lot in those games when it's tightened at the back end where, you know, the calmer we are, the more relaxed we are in those heightened situations, the better we perform. And we do a lot of training around that stuff, around brain training, under fatigue at training and, you know, preparing, just like players do. You go club scrimmages and you see those players are practicing the last 5 minutes of the game, kicking field goals. We do the same thing. We look at, you know, where we're going to be and what we're going to do and how we're going to handle those high-pressure situations at the back end of games.
Yeah. So with the three Golden Point games this weekend, I'm saying that it's skewed our GPS data a bit because obviously some of the officials, you know, ran for longer minutes than the rest.
A distance is definitely will be up.
And I'm claiming that that's the only reason that this bloke has won our marathon runner award of the week goes to the man with the greatest quiff I've ever seen, Adam Cassidy. He ran 11.87 kilometres. He was the assist referee in the Newcastle and Dragons game. So last game of the weekend, obviously a 13-12 scoreline. I think this is the first time that he's won one of the awards. I'm sure he'll be very proud of that, to run that distance with that amount of hair.
He's carrying some extra weight up top now, as opposed to a couple of other guys in the squad who probably want some more.
Want some of that, so, yeah. Our gazelle of the week goes to my little mate Drew Altram once again. He hit 30.8 kilometres an hour as the touch judge in the Parramatta and Cronulla game. And he also got our urgency award this week. He hit our high Axel and D-cell targets 100 times. So in that same match. I don't know if we should have a rule where you're only allowed to
win one award
a week.
I'm looking forward to the day someone wins all three.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting.
Yeah, it would be. For some reason, we don't seem to get a double up between your marathon runner and your gazelle. You get a lot of, not a lot, but it's more frequent that would have people towards the top of the charts of the gazelle and the urgency one. I guess they're more speed dominated.
Yeah.
But we don't seem to get as much in the marathon runner ones for some reason. I don't know if you've noticed.
The head referees don't seem to win a lot of these awards.
Yeah, except for Benny.
Except for Benny a couple of times.
Because it is a very different movement pattern. I think that's something that when two referees first came in, it was initially touted as, you know, coming in because the game was getting too fast and too quick and we needed, less physical pressure on the referees. But it's actually more difficult in that role. The benefit that the two referees brings is ruck compliance and an extra set of eyes on the field from an angle that we previously didn't have to help us with decisions.
Yeah, we actually, I have no doubt we work harder and we go longer distances and we're at higher heart rates since two refs come in. So, yeah, the big sell was, okay, fatigue for referees and they're making poor decisions under fatigue. But the biggest benefit is what you said. When we're making mistakes and there was on-ball mistakes, you generally find that the camera behind was a shot that got the mistake. The front-on camera, it was like, oh, what happened there? And then they'd replay it again from the camera behind. It's like, oh, he stripped that or he's lost that. So we've got an extra set of eyes there. But what it does, it also, it gives you some more confidence. You've got a mate out in the field with you.
Yeah.
You've got someone out there to bounce off and someone to bounce. And you know, when you listen to the audio, we do bounce decisions off each other at stages of the game. And it's why sometimes you hear the referee blow the whistle for like a knock-on and all of a sudden there's a penalty whistle because, you know, his mate behind the rucks tipped him in that I've seen something different from me and I'm confident that I'm right.
Yeah.
And 99% of the times we're right. So, it doesn't really take the fatigue out of it, but we train hard so that we don't get fatigued.
Yeah.
And, it gives us that extra bit of confidence and allows us to blood more referees in the first grade.
And speaking of when two referees was introduced, you actually have a bit of a different introduction to two referees years and years ago up in Townsville. Townsville?
No. Parramatta Stadium.
Oh, Parramatta Stadium. Jeez.
The first one?
Yeah, your first. Yeah. No. Not that one. Before this version of two referees, the very first
Sydney Football Stadium.
Yeah, the very first time it was ever trialled. Do you want to talk through that?
Oh, yeah, it's a bit of a funny story. It was a game, I hadn't refereed first grade at this time, and two referees on the field at the same time wasn't really a thing. No one was really talking about it. So we trialled a two-referee system where it was for fatigue. So Tony Archer was the referee. It was South versus Cronulla. It was back into the season. Neither side could make the semi-finals. And so Tony Archer went out and refereed. I sat on the sideline on a spin bike, just keeping warm, and then there was probably about 12 minutes to go in the first half, and there was a scrum, and they threw me on to referee 5 minutes of the game so Tony Archer could have a rest. And I remember coming back off the spin bike. I remember sitting on the spin bike for the first 30 minutes and the crowd was sort of right behind me and they're like, get him off, you need to get out there. You know, get this idiot off the field, he's hopeless. And I remember going out and doing a couple of minutes and coming back on the spin bike and then the crowd was like, now we know why you weren't out there. So Arch and I did that and that was my introduction to first grade. And, it was a bit of a trial to see how we could, you know, eliminate that fatigue factor out of referees. And the research was that you know, poor decisions were at the back end of halves and at the start of the second half. So if we could take that referee out for a little bit, he could rest up and get out of that decision-making mode and then jump back out.
What year was that?
That was, do I need to go back that far? That was 2003.
Wow. As I say, and then the two referees was first introduced in its, you know, current form in 2009.
So in 2008, I got dropped from first grade. I'd refereed probably, 100 games, maybe not even that by then. And, got dropped from first grade. The great Robert Finch dropped me from first grade, although he doesn't remember it, so I wasn't memorable. So, dropped me from first grade, and that was when there was talk of two referees on the field, and that was the first year of the National Under-20s comp. So myself and Phil Haynes got sent back there and did a trial in two refs. So all those people out there who are hating two refs can probably blame me for it because we went out there and we actually refereed it reasonably well, and that was the catalyst. That was the start where people said, well, this thing probably will work.
Mm.
And so, we were the guinea pigs and it worked and
stuck
it's probably
around.
Prolonged my career a little bit. So, I'm glad it's in.
Again, with the we'll go back to the football from this weekend. We'll talk about a few different decisions that happened that had some people talking or had some people confused. And one of the greatest things that I've seen a player do of recent times was Blake Ferguson. with his knowing the law about the touchline. And when the other team kicks the ball, if I'm on the opposite team, if I have my foot on or over the touchline and I touch that football, as long as it's still rolling, it's not still, then I get the scrum feed. And, you know, obviously this is a ruling that as referees we've known forever and a day, but it seems like a lot of people didn't know it because the plenty of people were asking the question about is that even a rule? But we have a good story of a number of years back. Finchie was still the coach back then.
Finchie was the boss.
And Tim Sheens is one of the great masterminds of the game and always sort of knew the game inside out and came up with something for this rule.
Yeah, so he rang Robert through the week and said, I just want to let you know that we're going to be doing this on the weekend to make sure your referees know the rules. And we're like, yeah, I hope they know the rules. They're refereeing first grade. And he brought this exact situation up. He said, well, when the ball's kicked to a corner, instead of my player having to take it and the chance that he gets, you know, tackled in a touch or tackled back in the in-goal.
Or tackled 1 metre by 1 metre.
Playing from a negative.
Yeah.
We're going to, my player's going to put his foot out and then touch the ball. He's not going to catch, he's just going to touch the ball so that and just let your referees know that it's a scrum feed to us.
Yes, so then we get the scrum feed and we can work it out from 10 metres.
And the reason it's a scrum feed to us is because if the ball touches something that is outside the field, it is out.
Hmm.
So by me having my foot out and I touch the ball is out by the kicking team. So they must have practiced this all week, and just so happened in the game they had on the weekend, I can't even remember who the Tigers, it was when Cheens was at the Tigers, who they were playing, but the ball's kicked into the corner. Here's Matt Utai standing on the wing and decides, I'm going to put my foot out and touch the ball. The only problem was he missed the ball. The ball rolls into the in-goal and whoever it was scores a try, the other team. So that didn't last too much longer after that.
So it's a great idea, but he's probably picked the bloke with the shortest limbs to do it compared to a bloke like a Blake Ferguson who can easily reach in the field.
Yeah, we saw it in another game on the weekend as well from a kickoff, I think. A very similar thing where the player was out and then just touches the ball, and the ball was out in the full from the kickoff.
Yeah, so that's another one that's misunderstood.
It might have been Ash Taylor.
Yeah, so that's another one that's misunderstood a lot of times by players as well, is that they think that they need to catch the ball. So from a kickoff, if they're standing on the dead ball line or on the sideline, they think they need to catch the ball on the full to get the penalty at the halfway, but they actually don't need to catch it on the full. All they need to do is touch it. So the moment that the ball touches the skin on your fingers or on your arm, whatever it is, if you're out or have jumped from out and touched that ball, it means that ball was kicked out on the full and you'd receive the penalty from halfway. You don't have to catch it. Speaking of the guys with those long limbs, this rule is actually different in the field of play compared to in the in-goal. So the touching goal line and the dead ball line, we apply what's known as the straddle law, or as we sort of sometimes call it, the David Peachey law, because he was the one who it changed whilst he was playing fullback for Cronulla. So especially when some of the in-goals were much shorter at some particular fields, Peachey would have a foot on the dead ball line, reaching out with one arm. The opposing team would kick the ball, be grubbering, and all he would have to do is touch it, and then his team would get the 20-metre restart. So he pretty much took up the entire in-goal, and his team were getting the 20-metre restart. So that's when they flipped the rule around, that if the ball was... If you, as the defender, as the person back there, touch the ball, then... you're the one who made it dead, and it ended up being a goal line dropout, which is why now when you see a ball being kicked, bounces in the field, bounces over the dead ball line, the player has to wait for it to land. Even if it bounces 5 metres over the dead ball line, I can't touch that ball until it's landed. If I catch it, even like I said, 5 metres over the dead ball line, I can't run out for a 20-metre restart.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that people sort of get confused with, where the players could be, depending on the ground, like if you're at ANZ Stadium, you could be 10 metres past the dead ball line and then catch the ball and you've made the ball dead because the ball hasn't touched anything outside the field of play. Yeah. So,
and it allows that, because it allows those attacking players running through the classic
jump back.
Classic Greg Inglis from the centenary test match to jump from the field, bat the ball back in, and the ball is still alive, which is why you can't touch it until it's landed out.
We're here to see tries. Everyone wants to see tries, so the more opportunities we give players to score tries, the better it is, and that's what the rule was there implemented for.
Yeah, and I like seeing players knowing those rules, and hopefully, after seeing Blake Ferguson do it on the weekend, some other players sort of catch on to it, because we see it quite a lot, and we think, why didn't the player just put their foot out?
Especially in those negative positions.
Yeah, in those negative positions when they're right near the corner post, and you think, put your foot out, get the scrum feed, instead of being either barreled into the in-goal, barreled into touch, or taking 3 or 4 tackles to get out of your own sort of 10 metres.
Those first two hit-ups out of the 10 metres are the two hardest hit-ups in the game. And for some reason, players just seem to make the smallest amount of... I know teams are revving up and pushing on the 10 metres, but it just seems to be that you struggle to get any yardage off those first two tackles. So, Could be a big difference.
The other talking point around rules of the weekend is one which always causes confusion at the start of the game, or before the start of the game, about an hour before the start of the game. So
that's when everyone's fresh and not fatigued and you know, just relaxed with headphones on generally.
So fans and commentators rarely see it, but given that we had three golden point games, you would have seen the cameras would have been on for three of the coin tosses on the field. And the coin toss rule is one that seems to confuse a lot of people. Fortunately,
including me sometimes. Nah.
it's one of the ones that I say is one of the dumbest rules in the law book. I'd like to.
Obviously, you didn't come up with that one.
No, I definitely did not. So the coin toss, the winner or whoever wins the coin toss doesn't actually, most people seem to think that they get the decision of whether they want to kick off or whether they want to receive. And that's not always right. The winner of the coin toss actually gets to choose which end of the field they want to defend or whether they want to kick off. Now, explain why that might be confusing, Gav. Obviously, if you choose to...
I'm confused already.
Obviously, if you want to kick off, it's pretty obvious.
That's the easy one.
That's the easy one.
And as a referee, you just hope they say, we want to kick off.
We want to kick off, and then the other team
we'll run right to left.
I'm running that way, and it makes it easy. Yes. But if the team doesn't decide to kick off, they usually say, we want to receive, and you have to say, which end of the field do you want to defend?
Yeah.
Now, why is it worded that way?
It's because you have two options. If you win the toss, you can kick off, or you can defend an end, and defending an end virtually means that you're receiving. So it's just what it is.
So explanation,
yeah,
Gavin.
I just don't know why we ever changed it.
So the reason why it was worded that way is which end of the field you want to defend is that according to the law book, the defending team is not necessarily the team making the tackle, and the attacking team is not necessarily the team with the ball. So go back to back in the day, 1908, unlimited.
I thought you were going to say 19-dickety-2.
Unlimited tackle count. No, you know, you're not going back 5 meters. You're not going back 10 meters.
Territory was the big part of the game.
It was all about field territory, where you're positioned on the field. Yeah, so if I was in your half, so if I was over the halfway line, and you had the ball, so you're playing the ball on your 20-metre line, then I was the attacking team because I'm attacking your goal line because I'm attacking your half.
Because territorially, you have the advantage.
Yeah, I territorially have that advantage, exactly right. So it's not always about who has the ball and who doesn't have the ball. Now, if the ball is on smack bang on the halfway line, then the attacking team is whichever team last had possession or last touched the ball. So if you think about it like that, take into account the definitions of attacking and defending team, then if from a kickoff, who's the attacking team? The ball's on the halfway line, the team are kicking off, so they're going to be touching the ball with their foot, they're the attacking team, and it's being kicked into, it's got to travel 10 metres forward. So automatically, the team who are receiving the ball, they're automatically the defending team. So pretty much by making that decision, you've decided which way you're running and you've decided that you're receiving the ball, which is why if you say, oh, we want to receive, then the referee, usually we don't say which end do you want to defend. We usually just say, which way do you want to run?
Yeah.
Because it just makes it easier than trying to explain the law book to them.
It makes more sense.
Yeah. So bit of a inside knowledge into the law book there. Might be a bit boring, but hopefully it helps you understand what happens at that coin toss. And next time there's a golden point game, you might have a better understanding, because I know the players still don't. We saw a bit of confusion there this weekend.
Yeah, the players struggle. And like I said, sometimes we struggle as well.
You understand why. With golden point games or any tight games in particular, it always brings a lot of field goals or attempted field goals. I guess that brings a lot of pressure to the referees and the touch judges when field goals are attempted.
There's so many different factors that we're going to look at in this situation, and this is why we train for these particular incidents, is because you've got things you've got to look at on the defender side. So you've got the referee who's got to make sure that he holds the team back the 10 metres for the amount of time that they need to be there. So when the ball clears the ruck, then they can leave. And you know, as the defending team, they're going to want to get up as quick as they can to put pressure on the kicker. You've also then got to make sure that the markers are square not only at the square, that they're the same. They don't leave earlier than they're allowed to, which is the same when the ball clears the ruck. So on that side of the ruck, you've already got that pressure. You've also then got the guy who plays the ball, making sure he doesn't grab one of those markers to stop them from putting pressure on the kicker. So already in that first 10-metre zone, we've got, you know, four pretty big decisions we've got to make.
If there's the wall there as well.
Then behind, once you start to get behind the ruck, now you've got to look at, okay, are there attacking players obstructing defenders from getting through the line, and are they legally or illegally doing it? Mm. So they can't be side by side. There's got to be a gap between each player for defenders to get through. So we've got to decide on that. Then you've got to decide that no one's been obstructed on the way through as well. Mm. Then you've got a kick that you've got to decide that the kicker's not taken out late, high or dangerous. Mm. Then you've got to decide whether that ball's gone through the post or not. Mm. Then you've also got to decide if it doesn't, okay, which players are now on or offside from the kicking team, because we've now got ball in play and another big decision to make. So you can see within, and that all happens within a second.
Yeah.
And so we're fortunate enough we've got two referees on the field and two touch judges there to assist. But each member of that team has a role to play to cover each of those areas of play. So, and you had it on the weekend in the Penrith Tigers game.
So a number of field goal attempts in that game. And there was one in particular which came off the upright arm from Josh Reynolds from memory. Different officials are responsible for different decisions, and we always say no referee is responsible or no official holds 100% of a decision, but we hold percentages. So we say, okay, my main responsibility is this decision, and then secondary to that is this, and then this, and then this. And at the end of the day, all of us just have to get the right decision at some stage.
And we do that, and that's why we say you're not absolved of decisions, because end of the day, if something happens, someone in that team has to get it.
Yeah.
Whether that was your responsibility or not,
Someone's got to get it.
We've got to get it right.
So in that scenario, Jerry Sutton was the head referee, so he's controlling the 10 metres, holding those players back, making sure that the markers aren't split, making sure that they haven't moved early, and that there's no infringements there in the ruck. Hold and go call is very important so we can judge any potential offside chases. Then Ziggy was the referee in the pocket. He also has responsibility over those markers in identifying whether they're square or not and if they've left early. As that play the ball is sort of unfolding, as the person's getting up to play the ball, as touch judges, we quietly identify who the person is playing the ball. So I think in this case it was Matt Eisenhuth from memory.
Yeah, it was.
So you have Matt. So we know Matt Eisenhuth's playing the ball. Robbie Farah's at hooker, and then we see if there's any people
why do you identify those guys straight away? What's the purpose of identifying those guys straight away?
Yeah, so we identify them straight away because they're automatically going to be offside from that kick, because they're going to pass deep to the person who's going to kick the ball, so they're going to be in front, which means that they are more likely to be offside. If that kick is unsuccessful, they are more likely to be offside. So we've already tagged them; they're in the front of your mind. And if the ball comes back to them, you know that they can't pick up the ball, or they can't be involved in a tackle. They can't make a tackle.
So what you're doing by that is you're taking away a decision you have to make.
Yes, later
once it gets helter skelter. So you're making the decision. And clarity around a decision when it's not hectic, because you know coming up it's going to get quite frantic.
Yeah, exactly right. So we put that decision into a time where we've got more time and more space and, isn't as frantic, and it may never come because he may kick the goal or he may miss and the ball just goes dead, and then we don't have to worry about it.
And play out the back.
Yeah, and we don't have to worry about it. But like you said, it bounces off the post and it's like a moment where everyone goes, and then you've already got the decision ready to go. The ball gets passed back. Ziggy in the pocket has to clear the kicker, so make sure there's no dangerous contact on the kicker. And then myself and Todd Smith was on the other line. The ball then bounces off the post. We've then got to follow. If the kicker didn't get tackled to the ground, the kicker could also potentially run those players onside if they're then outside 10 metres of where the ball ever was. So that's another quick decision we've got to make. That didn't happen. So we had offside players. The ball comes off the post. A Penrith player regathers the ball. Then Josh Reynolds runs up and actually makes the tackle. So he's that first man into the tackle. So we were able to play on. But had we not all done our roles there, we could
have... You're
guessing or making a bit of an educated guess. And if we get it wrong there, if we award a penalty to either team, so if we penalise Penrith for some reason. West Tigers win the game because they kick from in front, and get the 2 points. If we award a penalty to Penrith because we didn't see the offside players who were run onside. They kick for touch, you know, and then they get an attacking set. They're in good field goal territory down the other end.
So we broke that down there at a professional level at the top of the game, and we have communications gear that works really well. We have experienced full-time professional officials out there to do that, and it's still hectic and, very difficult decision. So take that back to the poor kid doing that in an A-grade game or an under-17s game, where he's virtually by himself. He's got two touches that can't really help him because they haven't got communications gear. And it shows how difficult some of these decisions can be for those kids out there running around on the weekend who are the ones who are probably going to get the most grief when they, from fans and that when they do get a decision wrong because they just aren't capable. Yeah. It's near impossible for them to get that right.
And you've got to think about that as well in a one referee game. You've also got to see if the ball went over the post. So we talk about on and offside chases, clearing a kicker and all that sort of stuff, but you've actually got to turn around and turn your back to those decisions to see if the goal was successful or not.
And sometimes they are quite tight as well, whether it's shooting near the crossbar, whether it's going under or over, if it's a really high kick and, whether it's going in or outside the post, all those curving kicks, and that can be difficult.
Yeah, so like you said, full respect to, the guys and girls out there on the weekend doing it by themselves, sometimes with touch judges and sometimes not, because, refereeing is a pretty hard gig, especially
pretty lonely gig too in those times.
Yeah, in those situations. Plenty out of the weekend, and, it was good that a few of those discussion points came up that, had some commentators stumped and a lot of fans on social media stumped as well. So hopefully we were able to hopefully clarify some things and not confuse you further, although with the coin toss rule
I'm still confused.
It may have confused you further. So what's the rest of your week look like, Gav? Where are you heading this weekend?
I'm back up to Townsville, actually.
Nice. Three weeks in a row for the Badgers in Townsville.
Yeah, we should buy some property up there or something. Move up there. So up in Townsville and Friday night. So, always enjoy going up there. It's always a fast track, so... We'll see what they produce up there. So, it's looking good. And that's it for me for the weekend.
Oh, very good. Saturday, I'm heading to Newcastle. So, 97 grand final, Newcastle, Manly. So, that's always good. There's always feeling between those two teams. And see I saw the crowd figures from the Newcastle Dragons game last week. There was just under 20,000 there. So it's a loud stadium as well.
They love their rugby league team. Yeah, and they're very vocal. Yeah. They're not afraid to tell you what they think.
It's definitely a stadium I like going to.
Very enjoyable.
My first trip up the freeway this year should be enjoyable. So with that, I'd like to...
Just before we go, sorry, Case. I just want to... sort of congratulate and wish well. This weekend is the first round of the semi-finals for the New South Wales Rugby League Junior Representative Competition. So the Harold Matts, SG Ball and Tasha Gale. And so obviously we've got all, the future of the game out there running around playing and the next batch of first grade players. But we've also got the future of refereeing running around out there as well. So I really want to wish those guys who've worked hard since November training the best for this weekend and the next 4 weeks going forward and good luck with it all.
Yeah, it's definitely an exciting time for the guys and girls at that level because it can be a big kickstart in their career on our pathway. So, good luck to all of you out there. As always, we like to try and get you to join our Facebook and Instagram pages. Our Facebook page is NRL Officiating and the Instagram handle is @NRLOfficiating. So give us a follow to keep up to date with what's happening in the world of rugby league officials across the country from under sixes through to the NRL. We hope you all enjoy your rugby league this weekend and tune back in next week. And thanks for listening to Refs Roundup.
Bye.